Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, what really happened inside the Branch Davidian compound before and after the start of the longest federal standoff in American history? We'll spend this hour with producer Charles Poe, who interviewed surviving members of David Koresh's apocalyptic religious sect to learn how he recruited new members from around the world and became convinced that he was the Messiah. Koresh attracted the attention of ATF agents following reports that he was dealing and stockpiling weapons and taking underage girls as sexual partners and wives, and he held federal agents at bay for weeks before ordering his followers to set the group's compound ablaze. Our conversation starts after a short break. Five years ago, David Koresh brought an end to more than 7 weeks of standoff between his Christian extremist sect and federal agents surrounding the compound. Koresh ordered followers to pour fuel around buildings and set them ablaze. Within an hour, all that remained of the Branch Davidian compound, its leader, and most of its followers were a few inches of ash. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Koresh may have ordered the act that brought the Branch Davidians to a fiery end, but federal agents and local journalists have also been blamed over the years for their role in the 51-day stalemate and its outcome. A new Smithsonian Channel documentary that airs next April 9th revisits how it happened and includes interviews with survivors who once trusted David Koresh with their lives and their souls. Charles Poe is the executive producer of Waco, The Longest Siege. He joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington to talk about it. Charles, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
Before we get into the details of the siege, I want to acknowledge that we have people listening who aren't old enough to remember any of this firsthand. So just to start with a couple of basics, who were the Branch Davidians? What did they believe?
Certainly. Well, the Branch Davidians were a spinoff in the 1930s of the Seventh-day Adventists, and that's a faith that is particularly open to end-time prophets. And David Koresh, he was originally known as Vernon Howell, had joined this splinter group of the Branch Davidians that was in Central Texas. And he recruited people from all over the world to come to about 10 miles outside of Waco in Mount Carmel, a compound where he pretty much had iron control over his flock.
How did he take on the name David Koresh?
Well, he took it from the Bible, David, obviously, from the Bible, and Koresh is a version of Cyrus, the lamb from the book of Revelation. And he claimed that he was the only person who could open the seven seals that would lead his followers to salvation and also launch the apocalypse.
And how did he attract followers to show up in Central Texas?
Well, he was a charismatic individual. I mean, this was someone who only had a ninth grade education, but he had a knack for memorizing and repeating Bible sections. He went on this recruiting tour around the world and basically seduced people everywhere from England and Canada to as far afield as Australia by really sheer force of personality. I mean, he was someone who would riff on the Bible and was very entertaining at it and convinced people that he had a message that would resonate with them. When we speak with the actual true believers, and there are still people who are still followers of David Koresh and believe they will see him again, they have a hard time articulating exactly what drew them to him, just that there was just this force within him that that drove people to really pick up their lives and move to Central Texas.
Well, he seemed to have this extraordinary confidence in the veracity of what he was saying. So it seems like, if nothing else, he gave the impression that he believed everything he was saying.
Absolutely. And he was a natural entertainer. He was actually quite a good singer. He had a rock band. You know, one of his followers, Mark Brough, when he joined, you know, part of the appeal was that he was going to play in the band with David Koresh or Vernon Howell at the time. And so he sort of combined an entertainer and a preacher.
Did he believe he was the second coming of Jesus?
Well, it's hard to say at this remove. He was interviewed more than once, including by some of my former colleagues at the Waco Tribune Herald. And, you know, he never explicitly said he was the second coming of Jesus Christ, but he certainly asserted that he spoke for God. And he certainly, you know, as he got more cornered, he took on even more, exuded this idea that he was speaking for God.
And he also believed he had this special ability to, like, decode secret messages within the Book of Revelation. Were those messages made public?
Well, he did have sermons that went out on tapes during the years when he was recruiting. But it was never sort of a message that was put down in stone, and it evolved over time. And as he gained a lot of power within the Branch Davidians, and remember, there were earlier leaders of the Branch Davidians, including a woman named Lois Roden, who, when she was 67, supposedly had an affair with Vernon Howell when he was 26. And Howell ended up struggling with her son George for control of the Branch Davidians. Once he won control, he sort of evolved his message over time and got more and more extreme. So when we interviewed Mark Bro, who again was a follower who broke with the group, he said that, you know, his mantra got more and more extreme over time. So after several years, he had something called the New Light message, where he suddenly declared that all the women in the group would be his, and including daughters and their mothers, and that all the men would have to be separated. And in return, he promised all the men that in the afterlife, you know, they would get their own partners taken from their own ribs, which must be better than the wife you have right now if it comes straight from you, right?
So he was justifying, he had, I mean, they were child brides, right? They were underage girls that he was claiming as his wives. I can't imagine that there's any greater sense of power than having the mothers and fathers of those young girls acquiescing to this.
Well, that's exactly right. And it's not as simple as they just gave in. We interviewed Clive Doyle, an Australian who now is based in Texas, and both of his daughters ended up becoming brides of David Koresh. And, you know, he basically says he wasn't entirely comfortable with the idea initially, but you have a choice. Do you follow your spiritual leader, and or do you protest and leave the group? And by the time, you know, you're living with these other followers, I'm sure there's a lot of sort of quiet pressure associated with that. If all of the group is deciding that the women belong to David Koresh, there's a powerful lure there. And, you know, he still believes that that was the right thing to do and is still a believer of David Koresh.
Was there any particular reason for setting up this compound outside Waco, or like the land was cheap and they just figured they wouldn't be bothered there? Why was that the location?
Not entirely clear. We didn't go into that with this film particularly, but the Branch Davidian sect that Lois Roden had begun was in the area in Palestine, I believe. And when Koresh broke away, they owned some land out in Mount Carmel. And in fact, you know, my friends in Waco remind me that this shouldn't be called the Waco tragedy. It should right. actually be the Mount Carmel tragedy.
So it's perfectly legal in this country, Charles, to we have freedom of religion. We can believe whatever we want. So how did the Branch Davidians under Koresh's control end up on the radar screens of federal agents?
Well, I think that's what makes this a particularly American story. I mean, this happened along the fault line of several core American values. The first one, obviously, is freedom of religion, right? So you can believe whatever you want to believe. But at the same time, it's also a core American value that the government has a responsibility to protect the innocent. And over the years, in the late 80s in particular, there started to become rumors in the area that Koresh did have an appetite for young girls. Polygamy is obviously illegal, and so is, you know, having relationships with underage girls. Once those rumors got out, certainly the Waco Tribune Herald started a multi-month investigation, but also local authorities started to look into the group. And the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms became alarmed when they started to investigate the fact that this group was also compiling a massive stockpile of guns. So, you know, the story has a lot of relevance today in this age of Me Too and Time's Up. Certainly the idea of a powerful leader asserting his control to the point of abuse, and even the gun debate. We all believe, you know, in the right to bear arms, but at some point when the ATF realized that they were stockpiling, you know, they found over 200 guns in the compound, some of them acquired illegally, that becomes, you know, a serious matter that you've got to look into despite the freedom of religion.
Why were they stockpiling those weapons?
Well, that's complicated. Certainly, there was an aspect of the group that was selling buying and selling arms as a means of making money. But the other fact of David Koresh's message is it was an apocalyptic message. He did say, even from the very early part of his career as a leader, that the end times were coming. And, you know, over the years, it got more and more extreme. His followers describe them starting to stockpile weapons and actually, you know, practice with those weapons in anticipation that there would be an attack on the group, and this would signal the end of the world. They wanted to be ready. They were training for it. And to some degree, you know, once the confrontation came, they were already primed and prepped for making this a violent end.
All right. So you've mentioned the local paper, the Waco Tribune Herald, a couple of times. I did not know that you had worked for them at one point. They were also investigating what was going on at the Branch Davidian compound. What kind of reporting had the paper already published before the siege began?
Well, I should say I am a Baylor grad. And so I was an intern at the Waco Tribune Herald back in the mid-80s. I had left the university and the state of Texas by the time all these events happened. But I was there in town when Koresh was starting to build his flock, which, you know, in the intervening years, I've always been fascinated by the story. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't directly involved in the reporting. But the Waco Tribune Herald had an 8-month investigation that ended in a 7-part series called Sinful Messiah. And the reporters were Mark England and Darlene McCormick. They started that investigation, and we interviewed Bob Lott, who's the editor at the time, because they were concerned that they had heard these rumors, in particular about the young girls, and that authorities knew about it and weren't doing anything about it. And so they started talking to former cult members, including Mark Breaux, who's in our film. In the end, they interviewed more than 20 former cult members, and even got some interview with David Koresh himself. They were ready to go out with that series in February 1993 as the ATF was gearing up to take action. And in fact, the ATF at one point went to the newspaper and said, you can't start this series because we're on the brink of taking some action. And after the everything went down with the 51-day standoff and everybody died, you know, one aspect of the story that has never been told before is that, you know, the Waco Tribune Herald and local television station were accused of being, it was their fault, in essence, that everyone had died. There was a lawsuit and everybody was under a gag order for a couple of years. In the end, it was settled by an insurance company. But the folks who were basically just doing their jobs trying to tell this story, they really opposed the idea of that they were responsible for what happened. They were doing what good journalists do, which is trying to understand what was going on in their community and report on it.
So you use the word cult. Is there any doubt in your mind that that's the appropriate term for this group?
Not in my mind. I'm not an expert on what constitutes a cult, but I think it certainly ticks off many of the boxes that in the popular imagination we think of as cults. This wasn't an established religion beyond Mount Carmel, really. There are Branch Davidians around the world, but they've disassociated themselves from David Koresh and his movement. Certainly, this was, a charismatic figure-led group, mm-hmm, with extreme views and extreme culture. And I think that pretty much suits the definition of cult.
And Koresh really didn't tolerate any dissent among the ranks of his followers.
None at all. And in fact, you know, the Waco Tribune Herald had reported that, you know, he kept changing the rules on his followers. So I mentioned separating the women and the men, but there was a point that Mark Breaux talks about that at one point he declared he was the only one who could eat meat. And then he was the only one who could drink Coca-Cola. And then he was the only one who could drink beer. So he was constantly doing a bait and switch with his followers. And one of the things that they talk about is that they always wanted to understand him, never fully understood him, but he still had this magical hold over them.
My guest is Charles Poe, executive producer of a documentary airing April 9th on the Smithsonian Channel called Waco, The Longest Siege. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or go to Twitter. We're @KERAThink. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is Charles Poe, executive producer of the documentary Waco, The Longest Siege. You can see it April 9th on the Smithsonian Channel. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or go to Twitter, we're at @KERAThink. So the ATF, Charles, installed an undercover agent in the compound, which is like such a brave and sort of gonzo act of law enforcement. Talk about the intelligence that Robert Rodriguez, which was the agent's real name, was able to provide to enhance whatever surveillance was happening from the outside.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary when you think about it. Robert Rodriguez posed as a follower of David Koresh. He was in the compound during the preparatory time when the ATF had a building just across the way where they were starting to do surveillance, and Robert Rodriguez was able to report back to them what was going on. And you would think with it, an agent placed inside, how could anything go wrong? But things did go wrong. And one of the interesting aspects of the case is this story of the day the ATF decided to move in. There was a couple of journalists, including a local TV cameraman, who were on their way to the compound because they had gotten a tip that the ATF might be moving. They stopped to ask directions of a mailman, a guy named David Jones, I believe. And he asked, well, why are you going there? Because, well, we hear that something might be going on. And it turned out that the mailman was one of David Koresh's senior lieutenants. Hmm. So he called the compound and told them that, hey, the ATF is coming. Robert Rodriguez is in the compound and hears that the secrecy is off and that they know they're coming, and so he alerts the ATF. And yet still, somehow, the ATF decided to move. And in the aftermath, you know, two of the ATF commanders were reprimanded and fired. But they didn't take advantage of the fact that they actually had an undercover agent in the compound. And that's one of the extraordinary aspects in hindsight of what went on there.
Yeah. So, obviously history tells us that this all went horribly awry. But the original plan for the ATF was only to arrest David Koresh. Is that right?
That's correct. And the key question, again, in hindsight is, was the only way to do that actually to storm into the compound where they knew there was a stockpile of weapons? It was known within the community that David Koresh was not a shut-in. He did occasionally leave the compound and go into town, and there likely would have been the opportunity for stealth rather than force in terms of apprehending him sometime when he left the compound.
And the ATF obviously understood the threat of violent retaliation, right? Or did they not?
Well, certainly. I mean, look, they went in full force. Yeah. There were a lot of agents there. We interviewed Rod Adelot, who's a photographer for the Tribune Herald, who was on the site and had the very first photographs. And it's extraordinary. I don't have the exact number in front of me, but they had two truck trailers filled with agents to launch this raid. It was not a quiet knock on the door and, sir, can you come with us?
So this initial, it was a firefight, a gun battle, right, between the ATF and the Branch Davidians. 10 people were killed. Did Robert Rodriguez survive that attack?
I believe he did. Again, we didn't get access to interview Robert Rodriguez. He did survive the incident. And I can't remember what happened to him. Mm-hmm. In the initial raid, 4 ATF agents died. 6 Davidians were killed. And really, once that happened, then things escalated quite quickly.
Who shot first?
Still a mystery. There are various claims that certainly there was one claim that a federal agent had shot a dog, and that was the first gun that went off. The Davidians will tell you that they firmly believe that the ATF fired first. But that's one of the mysteries that probably will never be solved. Once a gunshot went out, pretty much everybody was shooting. And there is footage of that, as folks can see in our film.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. First up to Alan in Grapevine. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious, at the start of the program, your guest had mentioned that parents were surrendering very young girls to David Koresh. being father of a 12-year-old, you know, I found that kind of shocking. Just how young were these girls?
Well, the youngest that was reported was 12 years old, but there were many of them. David Koresh had, at one point, and again, this is an anecdote that comes from Mark Bro, he said that Howell was quoting the Bible as to how many wives he could have. And I think the quote was 60 queens and 40 concubines and virgins without number, which tabs out to 60 wives and 80 concubines. He had pretty much iron control over everyone in that compound. And, you know, he seemed to have an appetite for young girls.
And I gather the girls didn't really have much say in this.
They didn't. There was a story, and again, former believer Mark Bro is involved in this. There was a custody fight with one 12-year-old girl whose mother was in the group, and her father had a custody battle to prevent her from bringing the daughter into the group. And a lot of the former members of the cult testified to prevent that girl from going, and that was successful. That was a Michigan court case.
I wonder what it's like to talk to a guy like Mark Bro, who, you know, really believed and was part of this and then broke away and came to realize that he disagreed with what he used to believe. I mean, how does he process the way he used to be and what he thought was right with the way he sees the world now?
Well, he was studying religion. He was getting a master's in divinity, as I recall. And he was, you know, he was really taken by David Koresh's message. And in fact, you know, in talking to him and through the course of the film, it became clear just how hard it was for him to break away. And I think one of the key breaking points was this new light message when David Koresh basically said, all women belong to me. Mark was in a relationship with another follower, Liz Baranyai. And, you know, Koresh had supposedly, you know, made a crack. Well, I guess Liz is all mine now. Aren't you glad? And Mark, you know, for him, that was a breaking point. This idea that suddenly, you know, you've got an attitude that is in direct opposition to a lot of the message in the Bible, which cherishes marriage. And for him, that there was no going back.
So after that initial gun battle, there was a ceasefire a few hours in. How did negotiations play out after they stopped shooting?
Well, we interviewed Byron Sage, who is the chief negotiator with the FBI. Once the ATF initial raid, in essence, failed, the FBI took control of the situation. And Byron Sage is a great interview and an amazing storyteller. And, you know, he tells us that, you know, the initial conversations with Koresh didn't seem unreasonable. Koresh had asked that a 54-minute sermon that he had recorded on tape be played on the radio, and he said if that happens, then he will surrender to authorities. So they went ahead and did that, and then he changed his message and said God told him to wait. So it must have been enormously frustrating to feel like you're making some progress, only to have, and I think Byron says it in his interview, how do you negotiate with somebody who's taking orders from God, says he's taking orders from God? It's very hard to find resolution.
So the FBI had a psychiatrist working on these negotiations as well. What were the conclusions about Koresh's mental state? Was he thought to be fully in control of his faculties?
Well, we interviewed Dr. Park Dietst. I hope I got that name correct. He was the psychiatrist who was doing a profile of Koresh. There was no indication that he was sort of mentally deranged. He certainly had some psychopathic tendencies, I guess you would call them, but he was of sound mind, certainly. At least that was the opinion of the folks who were looking into this.
Before the siege started, what can you tell us about, like, daily life for a Branch Davidian living in the compound? How much were they allowed to come and go? It might surprise people, for example, that someone was able to work as a mailman and also be a Branch Davidian living on the compound.
Well, sure. And look, this also changed over time, but certainly people did come and go. They built the buildings that constitute the compound. They would start every day with daily exercise. David Koresh himself was a late sleeper. He would sleep in until 2 p.m. in the afternoon and play with his band and occasionally decide to preach at 2 in the morning. As the events started to get more extreme, the amount of preaching and Bible study grew to a point where there was up to 15 hours a day of Bible study, and it got more extreme in terms of the message. So, one of the interesting aspects is this is not, as I said, Vernon Howell himself was a ninth grade dropout, but his followers included a lawyer, an engineer, a nurse, a lot of professional people who were quite educated.
So where did they get money? Were they all working, you know, off-site?
Well, they, I think, as happens with a lot of religious groups, many of them turned over their all their worldly wealth to David Koresh. I don't know a lot about how they financed all of this, but certainly with over 100 members contributing, there was no indication that they were going to run out of money.
All right, I want to go back to the phones. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Mark is calling us from Dallas. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Thanks for the program. I'm just kind of wondering, what would you say are some of the main lessons that have been learned, you know, politically, maybe culturally, even from a legal standpoint, in terms of our present day, how this might be approached if something along these lines were to kind of arise today and need to be confronted?
Thanks for your call.
I can take my answer off with something.
Yeah, I mean, there was a long investigation about what happened in the aftermath of Waco. And certainly from the ATF and FBI standpoint, the protocols changed. The term they used for that initial raid was so-called dynamic entry, which is this idea of massive overwhelming force. You know, you almost think of the shock and awe, you know, in Baghdad kind of approach. And in the aftermath, you know, the FBI and the ATF changed their rules of engagement and, you know, established that negotiation would take precedence over violent altercation. And I think that certainly has followed over to this day. I mean, when you look at other events that have occurred, there was the one in Oregon not that long ago. The government has a tendency now not to be quite so aggressive and to try to find other solutions. Because certainly once that initial raid happened, as I said, the escalation was almost inevitable. Once you have people die on both sides, then attitudes harden and it becomes much harder to find a resolution that's not going to be violent.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Charles Poe, executive producer of the Smithsonian Channel documentary Waco, The Longest Siege. It airs April 9th. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. How did it happen that some people were released from the compound during the siege?
Well, some of that was a direct result of negotiation. The FBI had said, couldn't you at least get some of the children out? And in the first few days, several of the youngest, you know, infants were released. And very quickly also, David Koresh decided that some of his followers should leave the compound to become, in essence, voices of the people inside. So one of them we interviewed was Sheila Martin, who was in the compound with her husband Wayne and 7 children. She surrendered to the authorities with 3 of her 7 kids during the siege at David Koresh's orders. And she was arrested immediately and put in jail. She did leave 4 of her children and her husband in the compound and lost them all. And yet she is still a believer and waiting for Koresh to return.
Of the people who remained, Koresh was making videos to demonstrate that they were happy to be there, that they did not want to leave.
That's right. I mean, he released a series of videos with his followers talking about how wonderful it was and that this was unfair. It obviously, you know, had some impact, but it didn't move the government forces that had aligned all around him.
Can you talk a little bit, again, for people who don't recall the moment this was happening, about the debate in the general public over the siege before it, you know, everything went to hell?
Well, I will say that's not an aspect that we cover much in the film. It was 1993, so you certainly had round-the-clock news coverage of this. I don't remember you know, on my side, I was actually living outside of the country, so I wasn't following any of the local or American press in terms of how people were responding. I think most folks, from the anecdotal stories I've heard, were just sort of horrified that this was happening and couldn't understand it. And I think that's fundamentally still one of the messages 25 years later, is it is very hard to understand how people can believe so strongly that they will give up their lives rather than surrender. And that's one of the mysteries of faith and one of the mysteries of this story.
All right, back to the phones now. This time we have Mike calling from Dallas. Mike, will you turn your radio off, please?
I'm sorry?
Mike, turn your radio off, please.
Okay, yeah.
Hi, go right ahead with your question.
Hey, very interesting discussion. I'm looking forward to the program. But has there ever been any clarity on whether or not there was any connection between what McVeigh did up in Oklahoma City and what happened down in Waco?
There are a lot of conspiracy theories surrounding Waco, and there have been a lot of different documentary investigations of Waco. We certainly, first of all, Smithsonian Channel, you know, while we might occasionally nod to the fact that a conspiracy theory exists, that's not something typically that we focus on. We want to focus on primary source history and understanding to the extent we can what happened on a factual basis. I don't recall any connection being raised between Koresh's group and McVeigh. Obviously, you know, McVeigh had a different worldview. And I find it hard to believe that Koresh, who was so sort of narcissistic and self-centered, would want to be connecting in that way to, you know, any other group. It was all about him.
My guest is Charles Poe, executive producer of the Smithsonian Channel documentary Waco, The Longest Siege. It airs April 9th. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org, leave a question at Twitter, we're at @KERAThink, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
God going to talk to me in the latter days?
It's going to be written.
And who's going to bring that book?
No.
So there'll be no excuses. He put also a new song in my heart. Many shall see it and fear and trust in the name of the Lord. All I care about when I judge men is one thing. Do you want to know the seven seals?
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Charles Poe, executive producer of Waco, The Longest Siege. It's a documentary that will air April 9th on the Smithsonian Channel. That, of course, the tape there that you just heard was Branch Davidian leader David Koresh preaching to his followers. I know that this documentary is built very much of contemporary interviews, but of course, you also had to spend time with, you know, archival footage. What was your reaction as you watched, I gather, probably hours and hours of recordings of David Koresh?
Well, he was a very self-confident individual. I mean, downright cocky. Mm-hmm. We had some footage that had been shot from an Australian news crew that visited the compound a couple of years before the events that led to the demise. And he was so comfortable with himself, even though, you know, most outsiders would think, When you start preaching about the seven seals, that's not exactly, that's material that's easy to manipulate, and you can claim things that maybe aren't explicit in the Bible because it's not written in an explicit way. And he did it with such confidence, and he gained confidence over the years as his members control, you know, gave more and more control to him. It seemed pretty clear that by the time the events that led up to the conflagration, he was a very, you know, I think he probably believed in himself as much as he might have believed in God.
It's pretty extraordinary that the FBI tried to use tear gas to flush out the remaining followers who were in the compound, and they wouldn't budge.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary scene. 51 days after that initial raid, the FBI mounts canisters of tear gas on the tips of tanks— and brings tanks in, and while the cameras are rolling, breaks through the walls of the house and the compound and floods it with tear gas. And the folks that we interviewed three people who were inside at the time, and they just describe, you know, certainly the tear gas, it was sort of overwhelming, and yet they were determined to hang in. And there were 23 children inside that compound when the tear gas went in. And obviously we'll never know what steps were taken inside that compound to keep people inside. But I personally find it quite horrifying that, you know, even as tear gas is flooding into the rooms, somehow people made a choice that 23 children would be going nowhere.
All right, I want to go back to the phones. We have Faye calling us from Dallas. Hi, Faye.
Hi. I was just wanting to ask your guest if there to comment on the similarities between David Koresh and Waco and Jim Jones and Guyana.
Well, it's interesting because there are certainly a lot of parallels, and there's another anniversary coming up on Jonestown. For those who don't remember that story, this happened in South America. Another an American charismatic figure who, in the end, this is where we get the phrase, drink the Kool-Aid. He and all of his followers basically drank poison and died. I think, you know, I'm not as familiar with that story, but certainly when you talked earlier about what is the definition of a cult, that certainly squares. I mean, it was another case where somebody had basically convinced people to leave their lives, give over all of their money, and follow a leader who led them to disaster.
How was the decision made for federal agents to storm the compound?
Well, the new Attorney General, Janet Reno, at the time, and I'm sure it's not only her, there must have been many conversations going on, there was an increasing concern about the children inside the compound. Again, we're going back to that original fault line dilemma, freedom of religion, leave these people alone, they're just practicing their religion, and the responsibility to protect the innocent. And I think, you know, it reached a crux where the government was worried that they had to take some dramatic action to help the children inside. We now know that that was a decision that probably shouldn't have been made. I mean, they could have prolonged that blockade and tried to starve the group out. I mean, they had their own water supply, they had a lot of food, but say that that blockade had not been, the siege had not been 51 days, had it been 151 days and they'd run out of food, you know, would there have been a chance for a negotiated peace or negotiated surrender? It's hard to predict that. And in hindsight, again, you just don't know.
Were there bugs inside the building that allowed agents to know what sort of conversations were taking place?
I don't believe so. That certainly didn't come up in the course of our making this film. I mean, Robert Rodriguez was human intel until the raid happened. But no, I don't believe that they had any sort of bugs inside the compound.
All right. Back to the phones now. We'll speak this time with Linda in Cleburne. Hi, Linda.
Hi. How are y'all?
Very well, thank you.
I watched from up north here in North Texas when all this was going on and didn't pay a lot of attention other than, as I told, you know, someone earlier, scratched my head about it. One aspect I learned from a friend of mine whom I made years later was that David Koresh was kind of an equal opportunity predator, and I didn't understand why the press never picked up on it. She and her future spouse were in school in Waco at the time, and that's how they met him. They weren't at Baylor. There's a tech school there. And they met him when he was trawling for victims on campus, but he was also hitting on every boy or girl who appealed to him. And I never heard any of the press pick up on this. I knew about his thing for young girls, but he made a pass at my friend's future husband when he was 18 years old. Why has no one ever mentioned this, and how many people would still support him if they knew where his taste went?
Yeah, that's new information to me. It certainly didn't come up in our research going into this film, and it's not documented in any of the materials that we've seen. I'm not saying whether it's true or not true. It just didn't come up. If that's true, it's certainly a fascinating element of it, but it was not, it just never surfaced.
I'm really curious about the order that Koresh gave his followers to, I guess, pour some kind of incinerant around the compound and light it on fire. You discovered that there's evidence that it happened simultaneously in three different places. Did they know that they were going to die? What do survivors tell you about what they thought would happen when that place went up?
Well, certainly not everybody knew what was going to happen. Mm. We interviewed a guy named Graham Craddock from Australia, again, another Aussie, who survived the inferno, and he ended up being arrested and spent 13 years in prison and then was deported back to Australia. He tells us in the film that he heard, and there was a lot of controversy at the time, how did the fires start? It was only after the analysis that investigators made that they determined that it was started in three different places. But Graham Craddock was an eyewitness in the compound, and he overheard other followers saying, start the fire. So we know that at least some of the believers, Graham himself, had no idea that that was coming. We also know after the fact that at least 12 Davidians, including David Koresh, were found with gunshots to the head. So somebody made a decision to start the fire, and somebody made a decision to do mass suicide. What we will never know is how many folks inside that compound were prepared to die, wanted to die, believed that this was the end times, and how many just were caught up in something that they could not control.
So many times when we consider a story like this, we want there to be like a good guy and a bad guy. And I know that over the years, there are people who say the fault of this is all on the ATF or the FBI or even, local TV and radio stations. There are other people who want to say the fault is 100% on David Koresh. Honestly, watching this story, to me, there were just so many mistakes made and a lot of... It's just sort of hard to absolutely say this wouldn't have happened if one side or the other hadn't acted a certain way.
Yeah, people are imperfect. And I think, as I said, there have been other projects surrounding this story that have taken a hard line, that Koresh and his followers were victims of government interference and aggression. Others who basically paint it as this crazy end-of-the-world cult that deserved to die. And I think... we were really trying to capture the complexity of this. It's not an easy story, and it's not fair to just point fingers at one side or another. And I think that, that's challenging to do in an hour-long program. I think one of the approach we take is really to try to speak to the people who were there, give them a fair hearing, and relay the facts as well as we can, and try to get into some of that complexity without turning it into sort of a false investigation that ends up with a neat and tidy ending.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It has to have been an interesting experience to speak to folks who still believe that David Koresh was right. People who followed him, survived the fire, but don't think that his message was inherently wrong.
Yeah, I mean, we opened the film with a sequence that I was initially a little bit concerned about, with Clive Doyle and Sheila Martin going to the graveyard where their loved ones are buried. And, it is extraordinary to think, after all that went down, that these are still true believers. They are Branch Davidians to the end. They believe they'll see their family and David Koresh again. And I wanted to be really careful that we don't just paint this again. If you're going to follow someone to a graveyard, it's possible that you could convey the sense that they were just simply victims. And we wanted to be absolutely clear that both of those folks, Clive and Sheila, made decisions to leave their loved ones in the compound, in Sheila's case, and in Clive's case, allow his daughters to basically marry David Koresh as underage children. And so, it's not a simple story. These are people who are making decisions on their own, and they had consequences.
It's strange to think that if, God forbid, something like this were to happen again, the American people could likely watch this live, right? Streamed over somebody's phone. Were you surprised at how much documentation there was of this thing that happened 25 years ago before everybody had access to technology to record everything they were doing?
Yeah, and I think, look, to some degree, David Koresh was an early adopter of video, as we see in a lot of the videotapes that he filmed and obviously the audio tapes that he filmed. If something like this were to happen today, absolutely there would be people in the compound with phones capturing events as they happened. It would be probably even more horrifying than it ended up being. We have another series called The Lost Tapes that only uses existing archive from the moment to tell stories. And we felt like in this case, there was still quite a lot that wasn't captured on film, and we couldn't do it that way, quite that way. But yeah, it is kind of extraordinary when you think about, we have archive of his rise, we have archive of him playing in a band, we have, you know, along with eyewitness reports, we have quite a lot of footage of what went down in the initial raid and through to the end. And it's a powerful story, and I think a lot of people have forgotten it, maybe not in Texas, but certainly folks around my office, they had vaguely heard of it, but they didn't know the story, and It is an extraordinary story.
Did we learn anything? Not from your film, but I mean, did we learn anything from the mistakes that were made handling the siege at Waco?
Well, I like to think we learned something about the seduction of power, about the power that one individual can have over followers, and certainly the seduction of power that federal might can represent. You know, this idea that, yes, you've got a bunch of agents, you know, wearing their gear and feel like they're in control because they're an armed force. Sometimes that isn't enough, and it can cause more trouble than it's worth. You know, it's hard to say whether those lessons resonate beyond, as I mentioned, the protocols and policies have changed with the ATF and FBI. But are we immune from making similar mistakes again? Not necessarily.
Charles Poe is the executive producer of the documentary Waco, The Longest Siege. It airs next Monday, April 9th at 7 on the Smithsonian Channel. Charles, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you very much for making time for us today.
Thanks, Chris. Really appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director of the show. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook, but also on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at KERA Think. My personal Twitter handle is at Chris Boyd Think. Any place you get podcasts, you can find the Think podcast. But if you're not a podcast person ordinarily, you can just go straight to the website, think.kera.org, and check out archives of the show. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.